Our next speaker is Ms. Laura Tobler, and she's a nationally recognized expert on state health care policy issues. Currently, Ms. Tobler serves as a program director for the health program at the National Conference of State Legislatures, which is a membership organization of the states. She has been with the National Conference of State Legislatures since 1995, and she serves as a lead staff person on policy issues related to Medicaid, health reform, and access to health care. Ms. Tobler has authored many papers, articles, books, and issue briefs on a variety of health topics. She received her Bachelor of Science from Pennsylvania State and her Master's of Public Policy from Rutgers University. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Laura Tobler, who will be discussing Medicaid and the new health care reform, changes and connections, are children at risk?
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. I'm pleased to be here to share this information with you and to remind you that NCSL is a resource for policymakers in the state relating to what other states are doing. Please call us and let us know if you want to know, what states have moved forward with their exchange, what states are implementing various components of the federal health reform that I'm going to talk about you right now. First, I want to remind you that Medicaid has always been a cornerstone for reform. The Medicaid program and the people who work in those programs across the nation are very familiar with change, are very familiar with using Medicaid as the base for especially coverage reform in the states. And New Mexico is a really good example of a state that has done that with their state coverage insurance program. There is a lot of research that supports the fact that Medicaid has improved the health of the recipients by improving infant mortality rates, reducing the uninsured rates among children. And there's a very, very strong connection between being uninsured and having poor health outcomes. Providing coverage for those people that are living with HIV/AIDS, providing coverage for women with breast cancer. So there's a lot of very significant successes that the Medicaid program supports in your state around improving the health outcomes of the citizens in New Mexico. The Affordable Care Act was signed in March, and it has as a focus coverage. So one of the key provisions of the new law is to provide a source of coverage to those that are currently uninsured. And so this slide just goes through some of the provisions in the law that refer to access. So first and foremost, it expands Medicaid significantly. I want to remind everyone that it maintains an employer-based system. So there are employer requirements for offering insurance, and if the insurance isn't offered, there are some penalties that the employer will have to pay. It maintains a private insurance market, and it reforms that private insurance market to make it more accessible and to reduce the opportunities for private insurance to lose those that they're covering. So it has requirements that eliminate pre-existing conditions. It eliminates caps on services. It requires guaranteed issue. So there are some regulations that right now the Department of Insurance in New Mexico is already implementing, because some of those requirements went into effect in September. So the regs already had to be changed and an implementation plan put into place. And then for those that go into place later in 2014, they're working on how they need to change state statute. And policymakers in the roundhouse may need to get involved in that, creating new laws, or it may just be something that can be done through regs. So as a policymaker, you need to look into that to see, what needs to be done to be able to implement those changes in the private insurance market. One of the things that was done almost immediately, which I know stressed out states completely, was trying to set up the temporary high-risk pools. It was put into the bills that were being considered as being implemented in July, and then the law really wasn't signed until March, and then there was this July deadline, and it was like, wham, here you go, here's our new law, and oh, by the way, here's this really big thing that you have to do in states. So, you know, to the state's credits, they rallied around that and got their work done around temporary high-risk pools, which are vehicles for obtaining insurance if you are, quote, uninsurable in the private market. So if you have pre-existing conditions that have left you out of private coverage, let's say you were employed and you have heart disease and you know have been with your employer and then you lost your job and now you're in the private market, and it's very difficult to get insurance if you have an expensive pre-existing condition. So the temporary high-risk pools were to provide access to those folks. It requires the creation of a health insurance exchange. And I know that this is something that many legislators and policymakers are sort of scratching their head and saying, you know, we can read what an exchange is, but really, what is it? You know, really, what does it do? So the exchange is a marketplace for insurance. And that marketplace for insurance will offer the citizens of your state an opportunity to review, to comparatively shop their various options for insurance. So think of it like Amazon.com. You want to buy an electronic reader so that you can read books through a little machine. So you go on Amazon.com and you put in what it is that you want to buy, and then you get this whole list of who is selling that reader, what the various models are, and what the price is. So that's what you would do. You would put in your sex, your age, where you live, and various other data, and then you would get the options for insurance coverage, and you would be able to comparatively shop with a lot more transparency than what's available today in the marketplace. The exchange also will serve another role. It will be a very important facilitator for eligibility for other public programs in the state. So there's going to be a connection, as Caroline mentioned, between the Medicaid program, other public programs, and the exchange. So some states will roll in their food stamp program, you know, so that the eligibility is seamless. So if an individual goes to the exchange, puts in their income, puts in their age, puts in where they live, then they realize that they'll get information that will refer them to the Medicaid program or that will tell them that they're eligible for the Medicaid program. So it, once again, has that no wrong door kind of a policy where no matter where you go to get your health coverage, you're going to get put in the right area to be able to get the coverage that's right for you, your family, and your income. It requires plans to allow coverage for young adults on their parents' policy. This actually was something that states really took the initiative on. This has been happening in the states for years, and as a result of state activity, it was included in the federal health reform bill and is now part of the new law. So the new law allows all children, young adults, to be covered by their parents' policy in a voluntary way. So the parents don't have to cover their young adults, but it will be allowed up to their 26th birthday. This was happening in the states because young adults were, population-wise, were the population that had the highest percentage of uninsured. So, you know, young adults, they may not go to college, and if they don't go to college, private insurance wasn't covering them, so they dropped off their parents' policy at 19. And if they went to college, they would drop off their parents' policy at either 24, 22, 23, depending upon the policy, or when they graduated from school. And we all know how tough it is to get a job, especially a full-time job with benefits. So they may graduate at 24, go on and look for a job, and only find a part-time job that didn't have benefits. So they remained sort of sporadically covered on and off insurance. So this gives them an opportunity to be fully covered up to the age of 26. And I think that's all I'll say about the access provisions. I borrowed this slide from Cindy Mann from CMS because I think it's a really nice visual of how The layout for coverages. You know, Medicaid will cover the poorest of citizens in your state. The exchange will cover those that are uninsured or don't have insurance offered to them. And then employer-sponsored insurance is also a big part of that. And notice there are some gaps between the arrows. So we all know that there are going to be some folks in your state that just simply won't be covered. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the financing that the state receives right now to cover uninsured people and to cover those that result in uncompensated care. So, for example, undocumented immigrants won't be offered subsidies and they won't be offered Medicaid. So they will be the ones that will be, you know, that will be dropping off through those cracks. Here's some comparative data. If you would be interested in looking at how New Mexico compares to other states, I selected some states that I thought are good comparisons. And you'll see that compared to the national average, the number of uninsured in New Mexico is higher. What you can conclude from that is that there are going to be more people, percentage-wise, that will be eligible for the Medicaid program and for the subsidies in the exchange. I didn't mention that there will be subsidies that will be available to low-income people up to 400% of poverty through the new health insurance exchange. And those tax credits and subsidies will allow them to purchase insurance through the private market, but they have to do so through the exchange. So that's one of the things that needs to be considered when you are having your stakeholder meetings around creating your exchange, or when you're hearing your bills that were filed this year related to exchanges, is you know, how this information is going to be made available to the citizens in your state that are eligible for those subsidies. And keep in mind that the exchange will probably end up being a very, very heavily relying on the computers and internet for getting the word out to citizens. So right now, the two states that have exchanges, Massachusetts and Utah, it's very much so a web-based product. So you go to this, you know, you go to this website, you put in all your information, it will calculate how much money you're going to have to pay based on whether or not you're eligible for a subsidy. Think of it in that way. That's why I used Amazon.com as an example. So one of the major components for coverage in the health reform law is expanding the Medicaid program to new populations and really creating a floor for eligibility. So anyone with an income up to effectively 138%, but the law says 133% of federal poverty level will be eligible for the Medicaid program. The effective level, however, is 138% of poverty because of a 5% income disregard that's built in. So that means that if you're an individual and you make around $14,941, you would be eligible for the new, you know, the new Medicaid expansion, or a family of three making $30,428. So for policymakers, the questions you need to ask are, how many new people are going to be eligible for this expansion? So according to the federal law, how many people in New Mexico are going to be newly eligible? And that's an important question because of some data I'm going to show you, that newly eligible folks will have an enhanced federal matching rate. So the state will actually get more money for those folks coming new into the program based on this, you know, based on these eligibility requirements. The other question that policymakers need to ask themselves is, how many folks are currently eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled? And those are the, you know, have been referred to as the woodwork people, the woodwork folks. These are the folks that, once the individual mandate goes into place in 2014, will be looking for a means of coverage because it's going to be required. Now, there are some question as to whether or not the individual mandate will get implemented, but let's just talk about if it gets implemented. So when we, in 2014, when folks realize that they have to have insurance, they're going to go to the exchange, they're going to find out that they're eligible for Medicaid, but they've always been eligible for Medicaid prior to the signing of the law, which means that they're not eligible for the enhanced federal match. So they will be matched at the existing federal match, which will be less than the new match. If you have questions about that, we have a lot of information on our website that can help policymakers figure that out. There was a study done by John Hollihan and Linda Bloomberg, and it titled, How Would States Be Affected by Health Reform? And these are numbers that I'm just putting out there as examples. The folks in your state are the ones who really know the answers to these questions, and those are the numbers that you should use. But according to this study, about 11.1% of the population will be newly eligible for Medicaid, 182,051 new eligibles, and about 99,400 and some will be eligible but not enrolled. And those are the folks that are going to cost a little bit more money to cover. I mentioned that the Medicaid expansion creates new categories. Historically, as Caroline mentioned, historically Medicaid was a categorically eligible program. So you had to fit into a category. You had to be pregnant, you had to be a child, you had to be a person with disabilities, a dual eligible who qualified. So the new eligibility will be really driven by income. So it will bring in populations that historically are not covered by Medicaid. And really, states were not allowed to cover them unless they had a specific waiver to cover them. So single childless adults who are not disabled, parents who are covered in most states but at a very low poverty level, and then former foster care children. This creates a larger Medicaid program. Medicaid is going to be more of an influence on health insurance in the state because it'll be a bigger program. And it's already a big program, as Caroline told us all. So the things that policymakers need to think about is, does the Medicaid program have the capacity to accommodate and to administratively make the changes that they need? During the budget crunches in the states, a lot of Medicaid programs lost staff. So there's fewer people to implement more changes. Coverage for new adults, this just lists what the law says about the qualifying new adults. They have to have incomes below 133% of federal poverty level. They're not eligible for full benefits under the state plan or waiver programs. They're not eligible for benchmark coverage. And this is where your state coverage program comes in, because the law says that if a state has a program where they're not providing a benchmark benefit package, that those folks could be newly eligible to the Medicaid program. And they're eligible but not enrolled, so they're on a waiting list somewhere. It provides all new eligible adults with a benchmark benefit package that meets the minimum essential health benefits that are built into the federal law. Now, you may not have heard about this essential health benefits, but it is sort of a theme throughout the whole law. The insurers that are offering plans in the health insurance exchange will be offering essential health benefit packages. And the question is, what does that mean? And I can't tell you, and really no one can tell you yet, because the federal government hasn't yet determined what an essential health benefit package is. So we're waiting on further guidance for that. But just keep in mind that that's something that you want to keep your eyes and your ears open for, because it is a fundamental component of planning for implementation of this health reform law. And, NCSL is working hard to try to get that guidance from the feds moved up. And I know that there are many states that are, holding off with some of the details about their exchanges until they know more about what the essential health benefit package is going to be. This is what the enhanced FMAP will look like for new eligibles. It will start out at 100% for years 2014 through 2016, and then go down to a minimum of 90% by 2020. The coverage for foster children is new, and it changes the existing law to allow Medicaid to be provided to former foster children up to age 26 who were in the foster care system when they became 18 years of age and at that time were enrolled in Medicaid. New Mexico has already expanded eligibility for foster care children up to the age of 21. This is up to the age of 26. So for policymakers and those trying to implement this, the question is, how does the state identify those former foster children for enrollment in the Medicaid program that have already aged out of the foster system? Other features related to the Medicaid expansion is that it does require states to maintain their eligibility levels as of the signing of the law in March 23rd, 2010. This has become an issue for many states who are struggling with their Medicaid budgets, who are struggling with balancing their budgets overall, finding that Medicaid is a significant driver of that budget and looking to ways that they can contain Medicaid costs, knowing that they really can't change eligibility. And when I say that, it just means that if you change eligibility, you are not eligible for any Medicaid federal matching dollars. So what's on the line is if you change your eligibility, you no longer get any of the federal dollars. That's what's in the law. I mean, we don't have any experience to say that that's actually what would happen, but that's what the consequences would be according to the federal law. The maintenance of effort expires in 2014 when the health exchanges become effective. And there is one state presently that has asked for an 1115 waiver of the maintenance of effort. Built into the law, there is a piece that says that governors can certify that the state is in deficit and they can be exempt from the maintenance of effort based on their budget. The waiver proposal that the governor in Arizona submitted was a little bit different than that. So it was based on the 1115 demonstration waiver authority. And CMS is considering that waiver request, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens with it. The law also allows states to expand early to those childless adults up to 133% of federal poverty. And that was effective as of April 1st. We do have a few states who have done so. Connecticut and Washington, D.C. are already implementing their early expansion. Washington was just approved, and the new governor in Minnesota says that they will move forward with this in March. This makes more sense for those states that were using state dollars to cover that population, and all of the states that I just mentioned were doing that. So in Washington, they had a program where there was actually state general fund dollars that were used to cover, to provide health insurance coverage for some childless adults up to and actually a little bit beyond the 133% of poverty. And now they can do the same thing, but just draw down a federal match. The match rate is not the enhanced match rate. It is the existing match rate. There's also some changes. Because we're focusing on kids, I included a few slides with provisions that are specific to children. So there are some changes around how children who are in hospice care are eligible for other services. So the existing law requires kids in hospice care to forego any other service, and the new federal law allows them to continue to entitle them to those services that they previously had to forego. Oops. The new law also creates an option for Medicaid to provide coverage for family planning services through a state plan amendment, which is a change. And then effective October 2010 requires Medicaid to cover counseling and pharmaceuticals for cessation of tobacco for pregnant women, which could affect children's health in your state. There is a big initiative in the law that focuses on accountable care organizations, and it's predominantly focused on Medicare, but there is some emphasis on Medicaid as well. And I just wanted to make a note that the law does allow clinics that are providing pediatric services to be qualified for that enhanced incentive payment for an accountable care organization. And there's some, you know, there's a lot of talk about accountable care organizations, and I think it's still something that we're working out. I was in a meeting last week, and, you know, we were talking about accountable care organizations, and someone said, you know, I think accountable care organizations are somewhat like unicorns. We all talk about them, but have we ever really seen one? And so the accountable care organizations is something that I think we're working on. It's of great interest to the providers in your state because it is a provider-oriented initiative in the law. They all want to know how this is going to work out and what kind of arrangements that they're going to have to make to qualify as an accountable care organization. And it's something that I would encourage policymakers to look into further, but I don't have the time to go into the detail today. Other Medicaid mandates and changes that are worth noting are there is an emphasis on prevention, and there are several things in the new law that either will provide new money in your state to focus on prevention services or provide research data on models that are working. So and that is one of the cost containment provisions of the law. There are many that are that have criticized the new law that it's weak on cost containment, that is one of the downfalls of the law. But there are some initiatives in there that, if implemented and successful, could result in cost savings. So there's a phase-in for Medicare rates for primary care providers for the Medicaid program for 2013 and 2014, which would bump up the payment for primary care providers who are the providers of those preventative services. The coverage of preventive services will be at no cost sharing to the beneficiary. The reimbursement of Medicaid services provided by school-based health clinics. And then there's also a provision for non-payment for certain health-acquired infections. And this is a initiative that already exists in the Medicare program, and it really denies payment for any infection or any health condition that was acquired when the person was being treated by a health facility like a hospital. And so Medicare has already been implementing that, so there are models that, you know, the state can look at related to implementing it for the Medicaid program. There are also a few states like Pennsylvania who, once Medicare implemented that, they took that and actually implemented in their Medicaid program. So there are a few states that were doing it for Medicaid prior to the law being signed. There will be a little bump in the FMAP, a 1 percentage point bump in FMAP for preventive services, so another incentive, focus on prevention. There are some grants that are available for the states for prevention of chronic diseases. You saw Carolyn's slide related to how 5% of the Medicaid beneficiaries really account for a large percentage of the expenditures, and that's really related to folks with multiple chronic diseases, people who have very complicated conditions. They're difficult, you know, they have difficult diseases to treat, they cost a lot more money to treat. So there is a piece built into the law that will provide some money. We're not sure how that's going to come down yet. They haven't really figured out whether or not what the amount of the appropriation is going to be. And then there is also a focus on creating medical homes, so coordinated care for people, especially with chronic disease. And some states have really taken the medical home concept very far in their Medicaid programs, like North Carolina, like Minnesota. And Minnesota has actually tried to make Medicaid a partner with private insurance and employers in that state around the medical home concept, so that it's all payers working on trying to promote medical homes in that state. And the stickler there was that Medicare really wasn't one of those partners in that collaborative, and Medicare is such a big payer of services. So, you know, I have heard CMS say that Medicare is going to be on board, that Medicare is going to, you know, really work with states to make the medical home concept a statewide effort as opposed to a Medicaid effort. And Medicaid would then be a partner with all of these other state-based payers. One of the things that policymakers need to know is that there's a reduction in DSH payments that will be over the course of 2014 to 2020. And it's about $14.1 billion between that time. And it's important because, remember, we mentioned those folks that would slip through the cracks and would still remain uncovered. Well, disproportionate share hospital payments, the DSH payments, are a source of financing for the state to be able to cover uncompensated care and to be able to cover those folks that don't have coverage. When they access the system, it costs money, and these DSH dollars help to offset those expenses. So the DSH dollars are being reduced with the idea that more people will have a source of payment for their health needs because they'll have coverage. They'll either be in the Medicaid program or they'll have coverage through the exchange, through the subsidy. So the DSH payment reduction is something that you should know about because it is a change. What happens to CHIP? So in your state, CHIP covers a certain percentage of folks that are low income and their low income children. And what the law did was it extended the current CHIP authorization through 9/30/15, and it will in the future bump up the amount of match that you get from the federal government, capped at 100%, so they're not going to pay you more than 100%. But in certain states, for example, in New Mexico, it's likely that your match will be very close to 100%. So it is a significant amount of money in addition to what you're getting already. So look at that as being a source of revenue that you don't already have, but it is in the future. It's not going to happen immediately. The other thing that the law did was it allowed CHIP-eligible children who can't enroll in CHIP due to caps to be eligible for either the tax credits in the exchange or other programs that the state might have. And it does require states to maintain current income eligibility levels for CHIP and Medicaid, so it's basically for children through September 30th of 2019. And it conditions future Medicaid payments on compliance with this maintenance of effort. So in budget discussions, I know that some states were saying, well, can we cut CHIP? Can we cut CHIP eligibility and still be able to maintain our Medicaid program? And the CHIP and Medicaid are now very much connected. CHIP will also be connected to the exchange, just like I mentioned Medicaid. So in 2015, it actually allows states to enroll some targeted low-income children in the qualified health plans through the exchange, as opposed to have them in the CHIP program. So there's going to be a real connection between CHIP and the exchange. And it's just one more thing that needs to be noted when you're creating your exchange, because those exchange plans are going to need to meet some basic benefit packages if you want to move your kids into the exchange. So what are some state concerns? The first and foremost is, although it's a federal law, the transformation is largely left to the states to figure out how they're going to make this happen at a time when most states are having significant budget issues. And the program that is really the base for coverage, Medicaid, has, by most standards, been underfunded for the states. So you're starting out with a program that's stressed. And, you know, that is, you know, I think that is a real challenge for the states. There's no coverage for undocumented immigrants. There's no statutory countercyclical trigger. That was one of the things that NCSL tried to push really hard. So, meaning that when the economy goes down, the states really don't get a bump up in their FMAP. When, you know, that's when everybody comes into the program. There are, you know, since long-term care is a real driver of the Medicaid budget, it is one of the things that is very important for states to look at as far as reforms are concerned. The budget impacts, those folks that I mentioned, the woodwork folks, the system upgrades for eligibility and interoperability with the exchange is going to cost states money. There are some states whose eligibility and enrollment systems are 25, 30 years old. They are going to be inadequate to meet the requirements for the interoperability with the exchange. So there's a lot of work that has to be done there. Now the federal government has bumped up the match for that work to 90%. So that's a source of income that the states can use to make those changes. Staffing, I think I mentioned that, you know, staffing has been cut over the years because of budget concerns, and so you have less people to do more work. And then workforce. Are there going to be enough primary care providers in your state to meet the demand for all those folks in 2014 who suddenly have a source of payment for their health care? And what the evidence shows that when someone has an insurance card that has been uninsured for a period of time, that they use the system soon and often because they have unmet health needs. The election turnover, I'm going to show you a couple slides, but the election turnover and the steep learning curve for newly elected legislators. You know, Medicaid is a very complicated program, and there are some very important decisions that have to be made in, you know, this session and in next year's session, and trying to get the new legislators up to speed to understand the Medicaid program so that they can make efficient and effective decisions is going to be a challenge for states. You know, how are you going to get word out to the public about the changes that you're making? And then just what the thing that we're doing is saying all along that states need flexibility to be able to implement this law the way that they think works best in their state. So it's no secret that across the nation, states are still struggling with budget gaps. And the real issue is that this has been many, many years of budget issues for many states. And, you know, some of the one-time monies are gone, and the cuts to be able to balance the budget are becoming harder and harder. And I mentioned that there's, you know, a whole slew of brand new legislators who are trying to learn as fast as they can to get up to speed. This is just a slide that shows pre-election 2010 what the makeup of the legislatures look like, and post-election 2010 we saw that there were quite a few gains by Republicans. And when we look at state government, including the government's office, the governor's office, we see that Republicans went from 8 to 20. So quite a big change in leadership. I also included some data in your in the packet on some additional non-Medicaid programs that were established with the Affordable Care Act. I don't have time to go through all of them, but I wanted to just highlight those, and if you'd like additional information, you can always email me. My email address is at the beginning of the presentation. But there was a maternal, infant, and early childhood home visiting program that was created. Home visitation has been very successful in you know, helping with chronic disease management, as well as getting people to needed services, as well as reducing domestic violence and other, you know, other indicators. School-based health centers got a boost in funding. There's a program to fund prevention of childhood obesity that was appropriated, so there is money out there. Pregnancy assistance fund for teens and for parenting teens to continue education so that they don't fall off the map. And there are other non-Medicaid provisions that clearly will affect children. I talked about some of them. The one that I didn't talk about is one that actually the media picked up on immediately, and that is employers are required to provide a reasonable amount of time in an appropriate place for breastfeeding moms to express milk, and there's exemptions for small employers, which has an effect on children. And I listed some other health insurance regulation that would affect kids as well as adults. Here's a list of resources on our website on health reform. Please let me know if you need additional information. I would be happy to help. Just give me a call or send me an email. And thank you very much.